Yeah, that's the Alan Parsons Project, and they will be playing at the Roswell UFO Festival this coming weekend in Roswell, New Mexico. How about that? And I'll be there, of course, broadcasting the program live Friday night. And a little treat for you, because I've got Richard C. Hoagland coming in as my co-host that night. I wanted to do something different, and you know, Richard's going to be there with Robin, and he's moving in here to do that show with me that night. And we've got a handful of guests. I'm telling you, they're going to be popping in and popping out all night during the program. But Rich will be up there with me, almost like his old days with CBS, helping Walter Cronkite. So Rich will be there, and we'll all be there. And I hope you're there too if you live in the area. And welcome back with Nick Begich. Nick, RFID tags, we talk a lot about them on this program. What have you uncovered lately? Anything new out there?
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, actually, I was with Catherine Albrecht. We lectured together in early June in West Virginia. Very interesting person. But RFID, you know, we've been looking at that for a while. And one of the things that I think you and I talked about, and I know Art and I have talked about in the past, was the idea of energizing these at a distance. And it came up in a couple of programs recently. And this is one of those areas where we're seeing some breakthroughs. You know, you've seen the reports on magnetic induction recently in the news.
Yes.
The very first report that I saw was back during the, it was the Las Vegas Electronics Show, and there was a press release that came out of there where they had developed a system for magnetic induction for charging up cell phones at a fairly decent distance, and that was sort of the rage, because it was taking advantage of old ideas of Faraday and Tesla, which were actually referenced there, and that the trick was they figured out a way to do it with only 2% energy loss, which makes it about as efficient as the energy loss in the normal close-range power grid. Mm-hmm. You lose a little bit of energy anyway. But then it came out later, it was just a couple months later, there was a press report about using a system for energizing RFIDs up to 2 kilometers away so that you could read them. And that changes everything, because that means RFID at a distance, for instance, when you think about them in every piece of property, imagine an investigation, say an IRS investigation, where the IRS agent walks through your house and sweeps your home, and everything in it has an RFID tag that uniquely identifies it and costs it out for the IRS, and it better all add up. You know, and the fact is, RFID isn't like a barcode. A barcode just records sort of the product grouping, maybe the name of a book or something might be identified by that unique number, you know, something unique to the product. It's a product code. But the RFID offers one step further. It's a serialized product code, which means every item, each individual item, is uniquely coded. So think about that when you buy something and then it trades and changes hands and so on. Everything you ever buy is coded back to you. That's a big shift in the way, you know, information is managed and tracked. If you think about electronic transactions doing the same thing. If you think about internet or electronic communications of all kinds, from phone to the internet to fax machines, whatever, all of that data somewhere today can be and often is stored. Maybe it's not going to be used now because the sort speeds aren't quite there, but that's changing too. And when you look at this technology, there was a press report in February or March this year about the first fundamental breakthroughs in quantum computing. And I think you and I have talked about quantum computing before. And this changes everything about everything, especially when you start looking at then accessing all of these massive data banks. In fact, the European Parliament, we brought some of this up early on, and they did a couple of reports. In fact, we're referenced in one of those. The work we did in Earth Rising is referenced in those parliamentary reports on surveillance technologies and the direction that it's going, and they actually coined the phrase technologies of political control when they refer to these types of surveillance technologies, because that's how they see them eventually being used and played out. And I think that's interesting coming from one of the, you know, more influential political bodies in Europe today.
Well, I got to tell you, when I had Catherine on, we were talking about the American Medical Association, Nick, and how they had just endorsed chips for patients, you know,
right,
to put your medical history and records on. So like surveillance cameras, I don't think these are going to go away.
No, no. In fact, even, you know, for RFIDs, for a lot of different things, for medical records, because when you start to think about it, miniaturizing identification, something that hasn't made it into the mainstream but has been talked about in medical circles now for about 6 or 7 years when I first started hearing about it, and it was how the medical profession is trying to figure out a way to get everyone to consent to DNA. Basically, because within the DNA, they can determine lots of things that might prevent, for instance, drug interactions of certain kinds, where people have this, you know, genetic predisposition to certain things. But from a medical perspective, being able to diagnose correctly and treat correctly, this is becoming valuable. From an insurance perspective, you know, you can see the implications of insurable risk. And this is a very dangerous direction, and ultimately it gets right back to IDs, because the ultimate identification is, in fact, your DNA. And, you know, at what point do you stop giving it up, you know, is kind of the question. Whether it's your thumbprint at the bank, which I don't know how many felons they arrest every year, but I'll bet you it's not very many for the sense of invasiveness that I think most people feel giving up a thumb.
Well, and what concerns me, Nick, is one day they will force us all to exist with this thing. I mean, let's assume, you know, we do a lot of banking with ATMs. I do. Okay. And I try to do online banking and all that. But let's assume one day they say, look, we're doing away with your cards. Because first of all, people are stealing cards. They're stealing numbers. We're going with RFID chips in you. And, you know, if they just do away with the card, if you want a bank, you've got to get one of these things put in you.
You know, it might be even a little different scenario. Imagine this. And this is, you know, what would it take to get the American public to do that, number one? Because many, 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 many Americans would absolutely object pretty vehemently over that. But could you do it in the right environment of fear? And here's my scenario on that. Think about the recent press reports on China's military advances right now and the amount of money they're spending right now. A huge percentage of that goes into what's called information warfare, which is much more broad than just, you know, hacking into your computer. It has a lot to do with that. It has a lot to do with looking at entire systems of economics and being able to zero in or to pick out data and use data in a way that gives advantage. And when you think about what's happening in China in terms of technology, what would happen if they hacked through all of those systems simultaneously and deleted everybody's data?
Exactly.
Now, that would be more devastating than all the bombs dropped in World War II.
Well, what would happen when our whole system collapses one day electronically? And it probably will.
Well, this is a big area. In fact, our military in recent press reports in the last couple of months have started to say, hey, you know, we're worried because not only is China advancing this area and lying to everyone about their expenditures, but more importantly, they now have an infrastructure that can produce anything that we can produce. They can switch the program on things, making little hand calculators, and now produce boards for missiles, for instance, and they can do it in as quick as it is to change software. The other thing is, and you'll see it, we saw it. We had all of our code for our websites are created by our own people, and we went in recently and found Chinese tables embedded in our code where people were going to go in and, you know, eventually hack in. Nothing was activated, and we don't retain.
Well, they were getting ready, though.
Yeah, but we don't retain, like, critical data on there, like credit cards or anything like
that,
because we understand the system. But just the whole thought, and we have pretty good firewalls, I can tell you. You know, and the fact is, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff were hacked by the Chinese at one point, which means, you know, when you think about power utilities and chemical plants and all these things that are now connected, you know, this is not a time to underestimate some of this. When you think about surveillance technologies, how would you implement that? You have to first have something that causes huge concern. And we have some of that. I mean, the biggest crime in America today that is the least prosecuted is identity theft. And it's sort of a conditioning process as people get used to the idea, ooh, I need something more secure. And then there's this sort of test again, as safety and security versus personal liberty. And it's always going to boil down to that question. And, you know, then again, you got to go, okay, why aren't we more aggressively prosecuting the criminals rather than making the rest of us feel like criminals? And that's really ultimately the question. You know, are we an unruly mob? I don't think the American public or any public virtually anywhere on the planet is. It's really a question of how do we allow technologies to move forward? How can they support us in a very unstable world? And maybe, how might we use our technologies, reframe some of our foreign affairs maybe positions, and maybe use these technologies to enhance humankind? We have that potential as well, and that's the saddest story of all.
Even with the great negatives, there's some great technology potentials behind it.
Absolutely, and it's only a function of, I think, you know, as this program goes out, a lot of other programs go out, and we get to talk about these issues, and people start to look not just on the doom and gloom side of this, but hey, let's look at how to redirect these technologies. And we've been challenged by the recent, you know, reports on surveillance again, and sort of raising all these questions. And we do need some clear-headedness, not a lot of emotional left and right dialogue, but clear-headedness about what do we want this country to look like in 10 years, and how do we balance our act out so it doesn't look like maybe East Germany looked like 20 years ago.
You know, I think, Nick, I really do. I think most people, lots of people listening to this program right now, just basically want to be left alone. They want to be able to have a nice job. They want to be able to provide for their families, enjoy themselves, whether it's simply listening to Coast to Coast or watching a DVD and barbecuing at home with a car that works in a nice environment that you live in. Doesn't have to be grand. Could be a one-bedroom apartment, for crying out loud. I think most people just merely want to be left alone, and they're happy.
Yeah.
But so many people who are trying to control, they're not happy.
Right. That's,
I mean,
exactly.
You got a 25-room house. You've got, what was a movie? One of my favorite movies is Let It Ride with Richard Dreyfuss. And he's upstairs in the jockey room, the jockey club, right? And there's, you know, two people there, this girl in this miniskirt and her older boyfriend. And the older boyfriend says to Dreyfuss, who was invited in there because he's winning and somebody felt happy for him, and he had a tape where a couple mobsters fixed a race, and he gave the tape back, so they let him into the jockey club, you know, as a thank you, right, just to keep him quiet. Anyway, the older rich guy said, ask me how many bathrooms I have in my house. And Richard said, all right, how many do you have? He says, I can't remember. I have so many. To make a long story short, why do people need so much? Why can't they just come back to a small common denominator? And, you know, it's the quest for so much that I think is pushing people to invade privacy, to make more and more money, and to really play havoc with this society.
Well, you know, I think that's true. It's really a question of some of the fundamental values. And these are, you know, there's opposing values out there, and they're not they're not politically right or left. They're just human beings making decisions. Some are ones we like, and some are ones we don't. But I think there is a certain segment that believes that that greed is essentially good. You know, the objectivist kind of view. They're out there, and I don't see that. I think there's better virtue in humanity that can be amplified. We've seen it from time to time in history. When we do, it's a beautiful thing. But it always seems that the temptation, and sometimes it's not money. In politics, for instance, often it's about the power. You know, it's not about the cash. It's about...
Well, the cash comes with the power, doesn't it?
Yeah, it pretty much does. You know, and if you look at a lot of these guys that come in and out of office, you see it. And, you know, the sad story is, once again, you know, ultimately all of us, the average people, are betrayed when we have the opportunity. I mean, you think about the wealth of this nation and what we've been able to do, not just here, but around the world in many respects over two centuries. And we've watched some things. I mean, we've had good and bad times. I mean, we used to have slavery in the country. Women had to fight for the right to vote in the country. So we haven't always been as free as we think we are. But we've gradually, you know, altered, and we've gone through tough times. But the nation itself, always in its times of crisis, fundamentally comes together. And I think we're at a point that's not a crisis, But it's sort of this unsettling sense of doom that have come out of both sort of an overwhelming economy and globalist sort of mentality, where people aren't looked at as human beings so much as we're looked at as taxpayers or consumers. We're sort of dehumanized as just sort of a cog in the wheel of a big machine. And that's not what we are. I think fundamentally, every one of us is incredibly, has most incredible potentials. And once we realize that, then things can really change on this planet. And I think that's where both our technologies can serve us, but not without a good, solid sort of ethical virtue sharing. I mean, it doesn't have to be agreeing about all the ways we go about getting to the finish line, but just the idea that we can do it within a framework, I think, is where consciousness literally has to change in this century, in this decade, I think, to stop what otherwise will be a very dark period in our world's history. And then from that darkness, we'll walk out of it.
So who is fueling this tension then, Nick? This tension of, you know, creating weaponry that invades our privacy?
It's primarily the same economic interests, those that are the most insecure that have the most to hide, in my sense of it. You know, when you look at the advances in the surveillance technologies, it's been, you know, a lot of this administration's kind of march in that direction. Often it's been referred to as a revolution in military affairs, where the technologies have greatly altered. The idea of some of these surveillance, like implant technologies, and one of the documents we've quoted before on this program is the Revolution of Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War from 1989 from the U.S. Army War College, which talked about using implants and military personnel and business travelers. It talked about knocking out aircraft using sophisticated electronic devices so that they knew no residual damage. It talked about doing things that most of us would, in fact, it said within the paper that it would violate the very essence of the Constitution. Then that paper went on to talk about these technologies being so dramatic, so important, that they needed to change American attitudes. And so the article, the paper went on and described that the only place and only way it could change was in an environment of fear predicated on international terrorism and international drug trafficking. And if you look at things since 1989, 1990, when the U.S. Army War College published that, and where we are today, that's driven us to the point where people are willing to give up certain data, certain information, in exchange for what they think might be safety and security, and truly is bringing in systems that otherwise we would strongly object to. And the military knew it. The other thing they said is that perhaps the Constitution didn't travel beyond the boundaries of the country within this paper.
That's interesting.
And when you think about this, and the argument they made was that if it doesn't apply, then you could do these things and you wouldn't have the due process of law and the presumption of innocence in trials. And look at exactly what is happening now. And in terms of what is going on overseas, we have done extraordinary rendition. We've done communication intercepts. We've got people with no right to under habeas corpus. We have huge things in the name of fighting terrorism. And really, we have to ask ourselves, what is really going on here is the effect of effectively is narrowing the control of the American population, instilling an environment of fear that is doing exactly what the U.S. Army War College predicted and suggested be done in 1989.
Well, I'll tell you what, Nick, when we come back, let's talk about mind control. You've done a lot of work there, and that's part of this whole puzzle.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing tonight, painting a picture that will look like a puzzle when it's all done. I'll be back in just a moment. Nick Begich, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you're interested in the After Dark newsletter, you get 14 issues for the price of 12. Pretty good deal. By calling 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. After Dark comes out every month. Great stories, great issues. And again, 14 issues for the price of 12. Okay, Nick Begich, mind control. Is there really mind control, Nick?
Absolutely. In fact, it's gone a lot further than most people can even imagine. And this is a subject we've been on for a while, and it was like almost, it must have been right after the HARP issue started to get into the play for us. But when we started looking at the issue of mind effects, which to me, one of the more sinister sides of some of this technology, as you see that develop, in the public literature over the last, say, 80 years, and we track that and put that together in book form. But when we did the research, what's just totally stunned me is how little opposition, even in the Family Jewels of the CIA just released, you know, there's references to many of the things that we talked about within that book, the Unabomber being an MK Ultra victim we mentioned in the book. We talked about some of the surveillance activities, some of the mind control programs that they ran in cooperation with the FBI during the 1950s and 60s. You know, these programs have been ongoing under various guises. During the Nixon administration and the CIA's operation then, you got to remember Watergate was broken into. CIA at the time under Helms was operating the program of using unwitting victims and mind control experiments. Those documents eventually released. But a lot of this technology, you know, as things have advanced, have become pretty dramatic. We had a conference in Dallas at the Lay Institute sponsored in March this year, and we brought together a number of experts. One of them, Elizabeth Rauscher, who's a PhD in biophysics, astrophysics, and geophysics, and most of her work in earthquake prediction and that work.
Mm, okay.
But her and her husband, William Bice, did some work on mind effects back in the 1970s and 80s, and Bill Bice is now deceased. But what they developed by 1985 was a method of electronic telepathy that they actually demonstrated in the lab, where you could transfer, you know, the old psychic symbols, you know, the square, the triangle,
yeah,
the squiggly lines. And they did this with two subjects hooked up to apparatus in two different rooms and were able to transmit with 100% accuracy in a number of test subjects information brain to brain. And what that demonstrated is an underlying principle of how information literally transfers from one person to the other. And so when you start to think about this and you look at sort of where the technology has gone, we have now the ability to control computer cursors by our brain. They say that as this science develops, we'll be able to do a lot more, where we'll not only be able to model the brain in terms of what's going on, but be able to transfer specific patterns from one brain to another. And that becomes a very interesting technology, but at the same time could be quite sinister. The thing about research in the area is it never stopped. In fact, the Office of the Navy, which now runs everything in the Defense Department, look at the new Joint Chiefs of Staff, the leadership in how everything is constructed. And in the Navy, they issued a protocol in November last year, November 6th, and it's posted on our website, and it's the Navy Office, their regulation 3900.39D, and it's on human research protection. And in page, I believe it's page 9, they talk about human experimentation, mind control, specifically only being able to be authorized by the Undersecretary of the Navy for those kinds of experiments. But it never ended. And what has happened today is the technology that's being advanced will allow for, you know, a direct interference. There's been a number of papers published over the years, Persinger in the mid-90s, which got into this sort of idea of heart being perhaps used in this way, and a lot of others have published since that time.
Why would you want to control someone's mind?
Well, you know, the story goes kind of like this, and it goes back to some of the work of Jose Delgado. He wrote a book back years ago called Physical Control of the Mind, and the subtitle was Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society. Most people ignore the subtitle, but these guys actually thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could sort of socially engineer the society using mind control techniques? And think about it. And in one level, the pharmaceutical trade has certainly capitalized on this. I mean, the biggest selling drugs in the country are essentially behavior or modification drugs, you know, whether they're Prozac, Ritalin, or what have you.
It's huge.
Yeah. And so, you know, in that sense, it's happening. And that's something that was actually proposed again in the early 70s, was rejected. It was proposed under the first Bush administration as a method for dealing with inner city crime. It was rejected. But gradually, it kind of worked its way in. That's sort of overt. But electronic systems for modifying behavior, if you stop and think about it, what Persinger said at Laurentian University was that if you could, for instance, magnetically oscillate the magnetic field lines around the Earth, electromagnetically oscillate them. In a certain way, you could create a sense of agitation across a huge population, and then on the news broadcast, for instance, indict some ethnic group or some country for all of your woes, and people would naturally sort of channel that negative feeling towards that bad news.
You could get people riled up to a point, Nick, where they would, you know, go, you know, like the Pied Piper and follow him anywhere.
Right, because you agitate enough, create that sort of dis-ease, that sense of anxiety where the brain doesn't operate necessarily correctly. In fact, you can literally disrupt the brain using, for instance, carriers, any carrier like radio, TV, internet. This is something that we've talked about before. It shows up in an article, The Mind Has No Firewalls, again, U.S. Army War College Quarterly, back in the late 90s. And, you know, they talk about being able to transfer technology that would allow them to transfer through any of these mediums things that would override normal brain function. You see the same thing show up in 2004 in Technology Horizons, which is the Air Force technology publication. From their electromagnetic directorate, they had an article on controlled effects, creating the same kinds of effects, being able to affect human performance at a distance. And then you have Sony's invention of literally something you put on your head that stimulates the brain to cause almost involuntary body movement, so you can move to certain dance steps, etc. That kind of technology is all coming and here now in a way that, you know, there's not any discussion of where we go with
this. Do you believe, Nick, that we are being beamed by some group, some organization? You know, people have called this program, and, you know, years ago I thought, well, I don't know, but now I'm not sure anymore. They talk about being beamed, that voices are being put in their head, and, they're getting these feelings to do bad things.
Right. I think some of those stories probably are true. And in fact, I'm convinced absolutely that many of those stories are, in fact,
are they being tested, you think?
That's a possibility. But here's the thing is, you know, most people want to point at government. But the fact is, a lot of these technologies is flattened out. You know, maybe it's a private person.
Private company.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the ways that you sort of escape the Freedom of Information Act, something put in, incidentally, after the abuses of the CIA in the early 70s, but that was put in because of that. You're supposed to be able to get certain access to data. You're supposed to be able to get sort of the inner workings of some of this. And now we get nothing. And it's, again, sort of a masking of what's going on. The implementation technology, could we be affected right now? Certainly. I think that's possible. Is it likely? I don't know under what condition you would take such a risk that might be detected, because there are, think about it, if all these governments, and I think many of them have developed these technologies, whoever uses them first sort of lets the cat out of the bag. At the same time, anyone else developing them knows what the signature is, knows what to look for. And so I don't think, you know, it's sort of like who gets to the race first, and with the advent of preemptive warfare, I hope it's us, because it can be a very bad scene, and I hope it's us with good leadership.
Well, I hope so too, but you never know.
therein lies the problem. And so, you know, when I think about technologies and I think about what are the great potentials, because, you know, over the years we've looked at so many different things and we see such great potential, and this sort of preoccupation of so many with sort of gadgetry and control. And it's something Brzezinski, actually, who is a big insider. I mean, he was one of the founders of the Trilateral Commission. He wrote a book, Between Two Ages, and he wrote it in the early 70s when he was at Columbia University. And it's a really important book. It's the subtitle, which is usually ignored once again, America's Role in what they called in the Technotronic Era. And it was sort of his analysis of what was going to happen because of technology, socially, economically, and politically, not just in the United States, but in every continent, in every major country of the world. And this was written in the early 70s. You read it today, and it reads like a script, like a history. But within it are a couple sections that really get to the heart of this whole book, which is the idea that liberals and conservatives both get really excited about the technology for different reasons, but they ultimately lead to a bad conclusion, which is a more directed and controlled society, some out of the fascination, some out of fear. But either way, we end up in the wrong place if we don't safeguard the basic principles that allow us to think freely, to create these incredible technologies in the first place.
Could some people, Nick, be driven insane?
Yes, I absolutely believe that. In fact, there was some of the early work in this area was a guy named George Estabrooks. And Estabrooks worked at Harvard University Labs in the hypnotherapy areas in the 1920s and 30s. And he believed that you could create the super spy by taking, he felt like one out of five, 20% of the population would be taken in such a hypnotic state, deep state of hypnosis, that you could affect them and create the super spy where they'd have no conscious recollection of going there into that place, and they could create a second personality. In other words, deliberately split a personality, educate that personality under hypnosis for 10 months, 9 to 10 months, and then unleash them into the world. And if they were out there as dysfunctioning as the super spy in, say, Cold War era Russia, and they got caught, they'd have no memory of who they really were, and unless they had this trigger. They did this work. His work, he wrote a classic on hypnotherapy in the early 40s that was reprinted in 1957 called Hypnotism. Another one called Spiritism, which was an analysis of spiritualism and transmediums in his take on that. And then the last book he wrote in the 60s, the most important, was The Future of the Human Mind. And it was right before LSD became a big problem, and he was recommending it in this book as a therapeutic chemical. And when you read his work, a lot of what he did parallels exactly what was going on within the CIA during those same years. And the idea of creating that Manchurian candidate was what George Estabrook's work was all about. But the brutality of splitting personality, I mean, when you take someone into that state and you split a personality, you don't put it back together, ever. It never, the person is never whole again. You can't do it. So this is, you know, this has gone on, and it has gone on without any redress, without anybody being held accountable. I mean, the family jewels have been released, but where's the accountability? And it's not been there, and it never has been there. And that is why we do need to pay attention, because the technologies we have today are so much more sophisticated.
I had a guest here, Nick, Roger Tolson, many, many months ago, who deals with surveillance technology. And he was talking about a case where there was a family who actually believed, they ended up being right, that their neighbors were microwaving them.
Yeah,
beaming microwaves at them.
You know, I get these reports. You'd be amazed. Well, maybe, George, you wouldn't. But I get these reports of all different kind of phenomena. And some of them, you know, are very credible. A lot of them, you know, they line up very similarly. Others, you know, are sort of way out there. But you know, who am I to say what's really going on there? What I do know is history has shown, and the American government has admitted, a 500,000 victims of human experimentation taking place in the United States without anyone's consent over a 40-year period. They've admitted to mind control experiments. They have new regulations to make sure they continue and can continue to do those. And they have a government that increasingly has become opaque as we become transparent. And that's a switch from the where we were originally constructed, where we would be guaranteed privacy and our government would be transparent. Now it's going the other way. That's a big fundamental mistake, and technology is providing the way, and we're not sort of keeping up with our regulation, sort of developing our body of law that ensures that those fundamental things that are important to all of us stay intact.
If we've got this incredible technology to, let's say, render people to their knees,
yes,
cover their ears, play with their minds, why aren't we using it with all these insurgents out there, let's say in Iraq, for example?
Well, I think probably at some point there's been reports from time to time that we have. When we first went in, Project Solo was used, which is a couple of different technologies. It was used in the first Gulf War as well, but it's a C-130 packed with electronics gear where we can embed signals sort of on the radio broadcast and things going on in the area and create an environment of fear, which is what we did in the first Gulf War. You know, when you're sort of mixed combatants and your own folks, if you're using a lot of technology, you can affect everybody in the battle environment. So being sort of embedded in an urban war, it's a different animal altogether. But we have deployed the weapons for creating heat on the surface of the skin for riot control, which you've talked about, and I think we've talked about before. And the thing about that is an RF-based weapon, radio frequency-based weapon, microwave weapon, if you will, and considered non-lethal, tested on Americans first, as the Air Force in September last year insisted that these new systems be tested on Americans before they're deployed. That was Secretary Wynn in September, September 13th last year that made that.
Thank you, Secretary Wynn.
Yeah, and so when you start thinking about, not only is it ongoing, but they're suggesting it be ongoing. I think we're going to see more of these technologies introduced in the coming years openly on the basis that Americans discussed for the bloodshed associated with warfare and the idea of fighting maybe a more humane kind of war is what's going to drive that direction. The other thing is, war is becoming, we're becoming removed further from the battlefield where these weapons then could more easily be deployed, because they say by 2035, we won't even be there as human beings. We'll be there with robotics. In fact, more robotics have gone into this war than any war ever, and has continued to increase. There was a story on this recently for, finding bombs and that kind of things, but I'm talking about more sophisticated, the use of drones that are armed, the use of unmanned aircraft, ground craft, etc. That's where war's going. It's going to be like a video game operated from controlled areas. Could be even outside of the boundaries of the war field itself.
Part of me believes, Nick, that they know there's an asteroid coming this way, and they know that by the time we find out about it, panic will be all over the place, and that they need all this stuff in place.
Well, that
something like that.
I mean, that could be. I mean, when you look at HAARP as an example, the Russians suggested that this type of technology be used as a weapon for doing that, for knocking out asteroids and comets and incoming space debris, on the basis that most of that stuff that comes into our atmosphere gets burned up. It's coming in at really high velocities, gets burned up before it ever hits the ground. But, you only have about 30 miles of atmosphere to deal with. If with HAARP, you can literally heat a column of the ionosphere in such a way that you push it out up to 200 kilometers additionally, and atmosphere will flow in, creating friction for those incoming objects. If you can project the trajectory, and you can get seven times more breakup time, if you will. So, I mean, when you start to think about those applications, those can be pretty interesting, sort of the flip side of what we're talking about. I don't think people would object to seeing some of that. The other is, and something that got missed, and I was with Ben Eastland in March this year, the inventor of HAARP, and one of the things that sadly is not being looked at is the use of HAARP for creating, through radiochemistry, chemical reactions in the upper atmosphere, for instance, for replenishing ozone or for knocking out specific pollutants, something the device is quite capable of doing. And, that's an important thing right now, at least as we're being
sure.
told by the media.
Well, what did the inventor of HAARP tell you he invented it for?
Well, you got to remember a couple things. First, Ben Eastland is a plasma physicist, and he's first class and a very good person. And he was looking at, sort of the military applications of a defense system and a system that could be used for the things I just described, yeah, along with the defense applications we've covered in the past. The one thing he didn't imagine, and he never imagined, was that it might be used for mind effects, and that's something that as he's looked at our material and he participated in our conference in March, he learned a lot, and he takes that issue very seriously, as do most serious scientists today. The idea of neurosciences advancing to the point where they are has raised huge ethical questions that have not adequately been debated. Even The Economist, May 25th, 2002, I believe it was, or it might have been 2003, the cover story was on the ethics of mind control.
Nick, let's talk a little bit more about mind control and HAARP when we come back. Also, think of this question, MKUltra, Montauk, is that where some of the technology for these directed energy weapons were created? We'll be back.